Welcome, ladies and gents, to the Grim and Bloody Podcast. This show is a presentation of horror, thriller, and suspense, and is intended for a mature audience. Join us at your own risk.
Well, welcome to another episode of the Grim and Bloody Podcast. Glad you're here as we close out February. It's already been crazy 2024. What can I say? I am happy to be back. I am happy Al and Kevin are with me, guys. Back in the saddle talking about horror. How you two have been?
Back in the saddle again. Here we go.
Well, I'm not going to top that, so... But I could be better. Stuff going on, but I'm here anyway.
Appreciate it. Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. I wanted to mention, I was gone for a week. I took the family to Disneyland, and after Disneyland, we had some time on Sunday. So we were like, there was a lot of places in LA we wanted to visit, and one of them was Hollywood. Because obviously you're that close to LA, you kind of get a little starstruck. You're like, let's go visit Hollywood, right? So we went to the there's an observatory that's really close to the Hollywood Hills, and you can see the Hollywood sign right there. Boom. It's like, oh, amazing. And it had me thinking, you know what, there's probably a lot of desperate writers in West Hollywood looking for gigs, right? They're living here, they're probably bunking with each other. You know what they need? They need ink tip. it was the funniest thing. I'm like, you know, I hope they know about ink tip, because man, it's gonna make their lives so much easier. And they just happen to be a partner of ours. We should be seeing the first ad campaign, I think, in May or June, and we're gonna be running one simultaneously with them. So they are our longest running partner, going on 2 years. We're happy to have them aboard, and they're doing some awesome stuff. You know, it's easy putting your script on their program. They send you constant emails talking about the new projects that they have, producers and managers and executive producers who are looking for. So this is a good ticket, at least a good foot in the door. If you're struggling or if you're just looking for more opportunities, you want to check out Inktip, because they are legit and they have a proven track record. So I wanted to put that out there.
Good for you. Actually, I've been wanting to sit down and do a little writing, and you know, they're exactly the people I need to go visit after I've done the writing.
Yeah, so, definitely. And if you're still writing, visit them too, because they offer writing help. It's another one of their services. Yeah, they'll guide you through it.
Writing is a soothing thing. For me, it's
cathartic. It really is
cathartic. Yeah. But I write in a different type of manner, not necessarily in fiction. I write about films. And
you write wonderfully.
Oh, absolutely. I love your articles.
Thanks. But it's fun to do, and I imagine that I could probably use still some guidance from other writers. Perhaps I should check out Inktip to see what they offer for those who write about film.
Absolutely.
Well, as I have learned working in film, you know what you know, you don't know what you don't know. And until you go out and you turn over a few rocks and see what the other people are doing and how they process and work, you don't know whether or not you're doing well.
Yeah.
Yeah. There could be a really easy way to handle this problem, and you don't know it because you haven't looked.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think the biggest fear being a writer is submitting your work and waiting for judge. Because writing is a solitary, and we won't stay too long, but writing is a solitary act. Right. You're by yourself. In fact, you want to be by yourself so you can concentrate. You finish, and then the next step is, what do I do next? You don't know how your work stacks up with everyone else. you might not have any contacts in the industry. You might not know who to turn to first. So services like InkTip are that easy to guide you in gateway. They're very nice. That's simple process to upload. It does have a nominal fee. It's small. It's very small compared to other services out there. And they have active producers and managers, you know, with ideas, and they're looking for work. I mean, what more do you want? If you just wrote, you know, a thriller that has six actors and three locations, you know what? That just might match one of the emails they sent out because they're that specific. They're saying we're looking for this type of work. It might be an easy match for you. We're not saying this is your ticket to Hollywood stardom, but it is a ticket somewhere. So definitely check out InkTip. I wanted to put that out there because I just happen to be driving through Hollywood, and I can say that not all Hollywood is beautiful. but yes, for all you writers out there and fledgling writers and soon to be writers, check out InkTip. You won't be sorry. So moving on to tonight's subject, it is the Amityville Horror 1979, directed by Stuart Rosenberg, from a screenplay by Sander Stern, based on the novel The Amity Horror by Jay Anson. This film starred James Brolin, Margot Kidder, and Rob Steiger. Yes, with sharp photography from Fred Konenkamp. I'll probably mispronounce that. This film also was, at the time, Kevin probably knows a lot more about it than I do, but at the time it had mixed reviews. Stephen King kind of shit on it, but later on he came out and said, you know what, it's not too bad. The film is not too bad. Yeah, well, it's still simple, but yeah, I kind of liked it.
What it gets, I don't know about the you know, the reviews. I actually, I'm kind of critical of it myself and might get into that, but what I have been fascinated by is that there is a lot of people who have stepped up and said George Lutz is not accurate. They've questioned this, you know, the whole truthism of the story and so forth. So I think it's a fun film, as Hollywood theater is. It's a fun film, got some very effectively scary moments. Rod Steiger overacts. Well, he's quite, you know, he's quite fruity in his performance there, but that's the kind of performance that's required of this film. But yeah, there's a whole story about, you know, back, you know, around about who George Lutz is, who this, you know, story is based on, allegedly real events, and there are some, you know, people who try to counter that.
Yeah, I agree. You know, movies that start off with based on a true story or based on or inspired by real life events, it sets an expectation level that you're going to be watching something that happened in real life. So they're using that as a way to elevate the horror and the realism. Like, this actually happened. You're going to be scared when you see this. I prefer the inspired by. It leaves a lot more room for interpretation and dramatics that you probably wouldn't have in real life, because we are watching movie where we want to be entertained. If we wanted to watch something true life, we'd watch true crime, we would watch, you know, National Geographic, we would watch Unsolved Mysteries, right? There are places where they talk about real life events as matter of fact as they possibly can. We're watching the Amityville Horror on the silver screen. We want to be entertained because we have a bucket of popcorn, which is, we're thinking, oh man, this is gonna fly out my head because it's gonna be so scary. We're looking for that. I know I was looking for that when I first watched the Amityville Horror, because I heard it, this is a real life house from a real life family. But the movie on its own, even they didn't say anything, I thought the movie on its own was very effective. I thought all facets were effective. The end, it did get a little frenetic. There's a lot of details that I just caught. I didn't know that there was a pink pig staring in the window when the father was looking. I missed that, even though it was on the screen for a few seconds, right? There's so many details that start flying at you at the end that you kind of lose focus. But overall, I think the first 95% of the movie was extremely well done, and it deserved the accolades they had with like a horror classic. We won't talk about the sequels. They've all been letdowns, except for you guys are going to get on me when I say the Ryan Reynolds remake. I like that one a little bit. I'm a fan of that one. But the original, we're watching and I'm like, this is why I enjoyed it when I first watched it when I was 19. It was scary, but it wasn't like smash over your head psychological horror scary like The Shining was, right? But it dug into your head and it stayed there, right? And you're like, oh fuck, right? From the very beginning of the movie, they start laying the seed like there's something wrong with this house, and it slowly builds until the end. So I thought using that method, the ending had a nice payoff.
It does, but as you say, it is a little frenetic. It's a little, I think the ending is kind of edited in such a way by Stuart Rosenberg, the director, that they don't want you to stop to take a breath. They don't want to stop to take a breath because the audience would then start to see a little bits of holes, you know, plot holes in what's going on here. It's like, just accept this. This is a wild ride. This is what you're going to get the end. Thank you for coming. And but it's an entertaining film, highly entertaining. I actually think Jim Brolin, more or less underplays, George Lutz, which makes it interesting when you see Rod Steiger showing up, overplaying in his role. It's kind of like a contradiction, an opposites going on. Margot Kidder is actually convincing as Mrs. Lutz, and Kathy Lutz. I liked how it kind of builds the suspense, as you say. It's kind of like very similar to movies like The Haunting and The Legend of Hell House, where, and this is a story, you know, this is another haunted house stories, where it introduces it, the story, bit by bit by bit, where you see little things in the beginning that are off about the house, that are off about the environment that the people are in. And then you just, it's like setting the tone, and then the latter half is the payoff. And that's what it does here. I think that Stuart Rosenberg is rather careful at doing that. He was actually at the time quite the veteran filmmaker who did one of my favorite Private Eye mysteries of the 70s, which is The Drowning Pool with Paul Newman. And he kind of treats it like it's a bit of a suspense, mystery at first, unveiling one piece at a time, what's going on, finally revealing, like you said, the pig in the window, and showing things and setting the tone that something is not right with this house.
You're talking about the pig in the window.
Yeah.
If I see something like that now in a movie, I say, oh, they stuck that Easter egg. That's an Easter egg. They stuck it in there so you go watch it again. Mm-hmm. They can keep talking about that. And I don't think I did that back then. I think that, this was put intentionally with reason. I don't know what reasons are, but there were reasons and they put them in there. And, the making the movie here with Margot Kidder. And I can say this because we were friends. Miss Kidder struggled with her mental issues throughout her life.
Sure.
And
as well documented.
Really, yes. Yeah. And she's very open about it. Lovely woman that she was. But, I have to wonder, I watched some of those scenes and then I wonder, did he tell her not to take her meds for a couple of days? And I mean that seriously. I mean,
that would be so screwed
up. She's pretty out there. I mean, I want to believe that she can act like that on command.
Yeah.
Because I like her as an actress. But really, if, some producers and directors might say that, hey, go off your meds for a little while when we're doing this scene.
I don't think that. Well, in the 1970s, you had more of the maverick filmmaker,
yes,
the new wave of filmmakers, I would say, you know, there were the William Friedkins who stretched boundaries, the Brian De Palmas who stretched boundaries a bit, and might have asked an actor or actress to do something. And there were certainly, you know, the maverick filmmakers like Peter Fonda doing Easy Rider and so forth. No doubt he encouraged the cast to get high and have some fun with this. But unless I hear, you know, read something that's, you know, that's to the contrary, I would think that Stuart Rosenberg is probably not the guy that, you know, that would suggest that. But there's a way that you can suggest it by inferring.
Yes.
By not suggesting it. And that may have happened.
And of course, you have to remember that people like her, they take, you know, meds like this are not, they're not taking a single pill. They're taking, you know, 10 of them at a time. Of different medications, and she may just have forgotten because, you know, shooting can get very hectic.
Did you all notice that when I didn't catch this until I watched the film again? Did you notice that when she's doing the dishes, she hums the theme to Superman?
I know. Oh, damn! Yeah. Now I'm gonna have to rewatch it.
Yeah.
Now, of course, that was a great role for her, and she lived with that for the rest of her life. So. That's one of the things I would think, you know, she did that naturally.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't, you know, that wasn't something the producer or director told her to do. As a matter of fact, I wondered, gee, if anyone would turn around and say, gee, copyright. So.
Right.
But yeah, I could see her just accidentally. Yeah, that's what came. I remember seeing it with Lost in Space, the original series, Bill Mumy. Was of course played in Lassie.
He was in Twilight Zone. I know that.
Right. No, but the mom was in Lassie.
Oh, so. June Lockhart. Yeah.
Yes. And apparently they use green sleeves in Lassie a lot.
Yeah.
I used to watch it. I can't pull it up in my memory much, but apparently Will Robinson decided to play that song at one point. And while she's watching him play this, she's going like, why the hell is this kid picking this song?
Yes.
Why this song? Really?
Right.
Had to go there. And so you just never know what connections are going to pop up. Was it intentional? Was it not? Who knows?
Now, and I didn't realize that Jim Brolin was such a, had a good enough sense on this film, with this low budget film. He decided to take less money up front and go with a promise of 10% of the gross sales after its release. And all of a sudden, the movie becomes this major hit. And he ended up taking in $17
million. Wow.
That is a shit ton of money back then.
Yeah.
Well, you know, in Star Wars, Obi-Wan, I'm missing his name now.
Alec Guinness?
Yes. He was off some of the back end, and he said no because he didn't believe in the project.
Sure.
But if he had, I heard some pundit say, figure out that if he had taken it, he'd have gotten over $1 billion.
Sure.
And that just hurts to say that I missed out on a $1 billion deal.
That would suck. I wouldn't be able to sleep.
It's probably better off to not know that at that point.
Yeah.
Or to not even think about
it. I have to admit, he probably has, you know, he's probably financially stable. He's done a lot of work, very good work.
Right.
But still, $1 billion.
And really, who could blame him for his choice? Because for every instance that we're talking about where you'd have missed out, there were a lot of big actors that doing, you know, films, horror films and so forth, where the film tanked, and and it could have go the other way, where you end up having it hurt you so much as helping you. So I can see where an actor would say, I'll take 10% of the 10% of the gross sales, and all of a sudden the movie flops. So you ended up taking less money for a film that did not succeed.
Yeah, even Mark Hamill and Princess
Harrison
Leia.
Ford, Carrie Fisher.
Yeah. Carrie Fisher, yeah. They both said when they made it, they thought it was a piece of crap. Yeah. They comment that, you know, they stick their head in the theater and coming next soon this giant movie, and Star Wars. That was how they would prep it, because Star Wars was just such, they just, no one thought it was going to be anything. So you can be wrong.
And even Harrison Ford still jokes about it. One of my favorite, you know, jokes that he did was he did an appearance, a live appearance in San Jose, California, and I got to see it. It was one of those cinema awards, the Maverick Spirit Award for CineQuest, and he's on stage, and somebody in the host of the onstage event brings up the name Star Wars, and everybody just like claps, and he goes, "Oh, so you all saw it, huh?"
Well, he can be snarky about it, but you know, going back to James Brolin here,
yeah.
One of the things, you know, you have to look at is we don't know what was going on with his finances at the time. He might have been, you know, he's a popular actor at the time, handsome man.
Sure, sure.
Mm-hmm. And he may have just been saying, "Hey, you know, that I don't need the money that much right now. Maybe I'll gamble."
Maybe he saw something where he took a chance on this, yeah, on this film, and he thought, "Hey, you know, this might hit with the audience, and see what happens." And it did. Whatever juju he was cooking up, it came true. This was huge.
Of course, we had some other really fun actors. Don Stroud is in this.
A lot of fun. Love Don Stroud.
Yes, he's.
Who is he? I'm not familiar with the
Father
name.
Poland.
Oh yeah,
Coogan's Bluff and many other films. He just a great. He was a character actor extraordinaire in the '70s. You needed a guy in a western or something like that to go out. Usually, Clint Eastwood, I think, hired him a few times. Don Stroud was he's the main protagonist in Coogan's Bluff. Which is the guy that Coogan is chasing throughout New York City, and the movie that became kind of the catalyst for McCloud, the McCloud TV series. But Don Stroud is a guy that really, it's like Luke Askew and other actors of the time. They're just like, you remember the face and you remember the name and stuff like that.
Yeah, he's a handsome man, and he's how to put it,
kind of ruggedly handsome.
He's ruggedly handsome, but I also mean it's kind of like it's a persona that he puts on,
right?
You know, you could easily see him being that guy that comes in and says, "Hey, yeah, I borrowed your car, so I totaled it. It'll be fine," you know, and you let him get away with it. Because he's a good-looking guy, and he's not afraid to be loud when necessary.
That's he's the cackling, fun-loving wild man.
Yeah. So,
if he could have been cast in Animal House, he'd be in that type of film. You also notice that Murray Hamilton shows up as Father Ryan.
Well, yeah, but he's done everything. I mean, come on. You practically couldn't have a movie without him. He's played every cop, every serious authority figure.
Every mayor?
Jaws. He played the mayor in Jaws,
Yeah.
John Larch is in this, also well known.
One of my favorite character actors, John Larch, who's another whose face tells the story. He is a guy, he's played, military men, usually government officials, that kind of care, very rarely a lead, but you always you just always remember him in the role. You have Val Avery showing up, you have young Helen Shaver showing up as Carolyn. Pretty good cast in this.
Yes. Now I want to ask a question about John Larch here, you know, your perception of him. Certainly a very good actor, very capable actor. And he's not an unhandsome man, but I don't see him as a handsome person.
No, he's very, very rugged.
Yeah, you put him next to Don Stroud.
Right.
And Don Stroud is the pretty one between the two of them. But he also looks like he's the smart one, the careful
one. Yes.
compare?
And John Larch is like John Anderson. It's like Jim Gregory, where he's not really like, you know, handsome, movie star handsome, but there's a certain, you know, thing about him that transfers over to the big screen and kind of appeals. Like you said, they can play the bad guy, but usually the no nonsense or the common sense type of bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's the guy that if he's you know, leading the outlaw posse that's about to get ambushed by the sheriff and his boys, he's the guy that takes a stop and says, "Wait a minute, I think there's an ambush coming up ahead. Let's go around these rocks and so forth and try to get out." You know, and of course it's usually somebody else that just doesn't listen to him, and then they go plowing right on through the ravine. They get ambushed.
the ambush.
Yeah.
As good as this film is, and many people said Amityville 2 was just as good, if not better.
I don't see it.
I haven't rewatched Amityville 2, so I couldn't comment on that. But what I could comment on is the total number of collected sequels, and this is a staggering number, even this day and age of sequelitis.
And parodies. Don't forget the parodies.
Parodies.
I was just out of a movie premiere, and one of their parodies had been the Amityville Toilet.
I was just going to say,
this list doesn't include misleading titles, but there's a total of 65 films.
There is Amityville in Space. I know
touch
that.
On the Amityville.
Oh, God.
65, guys. What
and it's
the
usually
hell?
What they do, and it's a really fascinating plot device. But it's becoming seriously overused. Well, they'll take something like a antique from the Amityville house, it's reported to be from the Amityville house, and say that the spirit that possessed the house also possessed the antique. So the antique could show up at a garage sale in Florida, and all of a sudden there's new horrific events that are happening. It's a great screenwriter's trick that's used. That's why you'll see like the Amityville the Amityville pinball machine, because the pinball machine was inside the Amityville house when it got destroyed, and now it's all of a sudden ending up in New Jersey.
If there are demons, Jersey be where it come from. As someone who looked at antiques a bit, this is actually something antique dealers will do. They'll have an estate sale in a big old house, and they'll bring in a bunch of reproductions and stick them in the house because, you know, the house is filled with antiques. You're coming to buy antiques.
Sure.
You're not going to question if that vase is a reproduction or not.
Well, and how many films have we seen where the focal point is a haunted antique?
Oh, yeah. A million. Sure. An antique, a piece of jewelry.
Sure.
Anything.
Sure. But you said 64, huh? Anthony, you said 64?
65.
Sorry, he's trying to count that high.
I'm looking at this list. Here's some names for you guys.
Well, go ahead.
Amityville, Gas Chamber. You already said Amityville in Space. How about Amityville, Karen? Amityville, Christmas Vacation.
I haven't heard that one. Okay, that's I'll have to...
If that's any case, I'll watch it.
The Amityville, Cute Farting Cat, which is a short...
That's
Amityville
a
YouTube, Death Toilet. Right? Amityville Job Interview. Like, what the hell is going on, people?
Wait a minute. Is some of this YouTube videos that people just...
Amityville Vibrator.
Yeah, I know about that one.
Amityville in the Hood. That must have been made in the 90s. Nobody calls it the Hood anymore.
I'm looking up Amityville Christmas Vacation. I'm seeing no actors of note.
Oh, come on, it's got to have Chevy Chase in it.
There is an actor who plays a character named Wally Griswold.
Ah, yeah!
Oh, man.
So that's the loose connection to
this is one of those series that nowadays, if I see Amityville anywhere near
the title or description, I am moving on fast because holy shit, it's a crying shame that a good film like the 79 and the sequel, which is debatable, has been reduced to Amityville Job Interview. It is a shame, but then I always go back to say, you know what, we still have the classic. You know, people still look at that in reverence.
Well, what I was going to tell you is be careful on avoiding the other 63, you know, plus, because there is the occasional one that is actually pretty decent. And what I'm going to say is targeting the, you know, the first three films. I actually did think that Amityville 2, The Possession, is pretty good, especially when you have James Olsen and you have you have Burt Young, the late Burt Young, who passed away just a year or two ago. It's a really good cast, and it kind of gives an interesting backstory to how the this whole thing took place. And Amityville 3, I will say it's interesting because it was part of that new revised craze for 3D in the early
80s. Yeah. God, that was horrible. Everything had to be 3D.
3D is always horrible. Remember that.
And you got a guy who's mostly a Broadway star and a stage actor who did the occasional film, Tony Roberts, as the lead, and he's actually, you know, fairly decent in the role that he has. And if you take it kind of the film as kind of an out and out, like a slightly camp, you know, type of story, you might be entertained by it. But the rest, right after part three, which I understand didn't do too well at the box office, the next sequel was a cable, you know, sequel made for, you know, television. And I think I only saw it because it has one of my favorite actresses, Patty Dugaston, you know, in it. But the rest, it goes downhill from there. I've lost interest.
What do you say we put a bow on this, guys? What do we give Amityville 79? Where does this sit in your pantheon of top 10 horror movies ever?
In the, well, I guess we could say if it's in the haunted house spectrum, it would be in my top four, top five of the haunted house type of chillers, with like The Haunting, Legend of Hell House, The Uninvited.
Let's say the world's about to end. Huh? You can only grab 10 horror movies. Mm-hmm. From everything. Is it in your top 10?
No.
No? Al, yours?
No.
Yeah, I'd have to.
Well, I respect the movie and the work it did and so forth.
Sure.
It was never really something that made me hold on to the seat. You know, that, right. I'm sitting in.
Exactly.
It's worthy to watch, but it's not going to give me nightmares. Sure. There have been movies that I've watched where I'm now going to leave the light on, but this wasn't one of them.
Yeah, there's been for me on both spectrums movies that are like scary and that have had me leave the light on, and then there are movies that are so bad they impact me in another way. But this is not top 10.
How about you, Anthony?
I'll agree it's not top 10. If I had to take 10 VHS movies with me into the bunker, if this is Greenland starring Gerard Butler and the comet's about to wipe out the planet, and there's a DVD vendor right outside said, hey, you can take 10 movies with you, you're gonna be in there for 2 years, everything else is gonna get wiped the shit out, I think I'm leaving Amityville.
Why do you gotta drag Gerard Butler into this?
Oh man, I love that guy.
He's a decent enough actor who happens to do some shit films. Come
on. Greenland was good. They're making a sequel. It made money.
I did like Olympus Has Fallen.
Hey, I'm a sucker for disaster films. I'll watch pretty much anything that's not on Tubi.
I'm the same way with action films. So that's why I kind of got into the Olympus Has Fallen.
Oh, that was good. Yeah, I love those. Yeah,
I like
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
All right, guys. All right. Well, that's our show. You heard it here first, right? Amityville, good movie, but
but probably not in your top 10, just because from 1979 to 2024, there's just been too many good quality, nuanced films that
don't
have come
reach
about.
For it. If when Armageddon is ready to happen,
Don't reach for it.
Let it go.
This movie's got friend. If they say they're going to stop by sometime, you tell them call first.
Well, that's our time, guys. Anthony DeRoan, Kevin Nicholson, Al Omega, you want to take us out?
As always, remember to keep America strong, watch horror films.
Night, everybody.
Good night.